Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Elisa Alpert's second novel, After Birth, is a new mother's darkly funny and honest account of isolation, disappointment, and self-discovery. Author Lydia Davis called it, quote, a fast-talking, opinionated, moody, funny, and slightly desperate account of the attempt to recover from having a baby. Alpert's previous books include the novel The Book of Dahlia and the short story collection How This Night Is Different, winner of the Moment Magazine Emerging Writer Award for Short Fiction. It's a great pleasure to welcome Elisa Alpert to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us. What a great pleasure.
Great to be here.
So what brought you down this particular path? You would assume it's childbirth.
You could assume that. That wouldn't be wrong. I'm a believer in making fiction out of what I know best. So wherever life leads me, I tend to want to explore it via narrative.
So at what point in life leading you there does the actual process of writing and thinking and percolating a novel?
It sort of boils over. I kind of sit with things for enough time, and then at some point I can't not write about it. I marinate in experiences or life cycle moments, and then there comes a time where I feel like I am called to tell a story.
When it comes to the telling of the story, of that calling, is it done in your mind in the sense of, do you know where it fully is going to go? Or is the writing the exploration of finding out where you have been and what you have gone through?
The writing is very much an exploration. I write to find out what I know. I write to make sense of things. You know, to tell a story, you have to be situated on a safe shore, as it were. So in some ways, I think the act of writing is almost a directive to get situated on a safe shore so that one can begin to tell the story.
Talk a little bit about the definition of a safe shore, of what that is to you.
I think a safe shore means that you've found a place to begin, that you've managed somehow to plant your feet on the other side of an experience and begin to articulate some of the things that you've learned along the way. So for me, the character of Ari, who's the narrator of this novel, she arrived fully formed. And it was when I began to hear her voice that I felt like, okay, I am ready to tell this story and to see where she takes me.
So she has given birth to a walker, and mm-hmm. the story picks up about a year in. Mm-hmm. And of looking at where she is and perhaps not as far along as she would want to be.
Yeah. Any big life transformation is a kind of a two steps forward, one step back endeavor in my experience. And I was interested in this character as she's flailing. She's really trying to figure out what this all means and who she is and how it all adds up to the life that she's in. But she's not always very graceful or nice about it, and she doesn't have fantastic perspective yet.
And one of the things I found fascinating about the novel, and I'll have you read a little bit in a moment, is that it is very much a book about a feeling of isolation, of loneliness, and yet being around people and still feeling alone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's it's something that we learn when we grow up, is that loneliness is inevitable, that there's no cure for it, that marriage, friendship, motherhood, fatherhood, daughterhood, sisterhood, nothing can save us from that. And I think that's what Ari comes to understand and starts to make peace with.
What is it like to write a character that often is difficult for the reader, and I'll ask about the writer's perspective in a moment, but to be sympathetic to?
Those are the characters I'm drawn to. They ring the most true to me. I find it very difficult to be sympathetic or empathetic to, you know, people in the world. often in a daily way, you know.
It is a challenge, isn't it?
It is. So it's strange to me that one would, you know, pretend that, here's a character who's wonderfully easy to like, because even our most intimate loved ones are not always easy to like, sometimes even less so. So I'm interested in characters who challenge that kind of easy, you know, oh, here I am, and I'm your new best friend, and it's so easy to love me. I mean, it's not real. It's a lie.
I was just talking to novelist Miranda July about this, and she said that one of the things in her latest novel is that in writing the character, she would have to tone it back every once in a while and say, okay, this one phrase will make this character just a little bit less vile.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever find that okay, to make this appealing and to have people want to read about this woman and not just neglect them completely, that I'm going to have to dial it back a little?
I relied on my editor for that. She, my editor, Lauren, is really gifted and told me exactly when I needed to dial it back just a bit here and there. And I trusted her because she was my best reader. And I tend to go too far as a kind of a way of life.
And don't we as a society in general, perhaps, and maybe I'll get in trouble for saying this, I'll see how it goes over with you, and then we'll go from there. But don't we as a society tend to be rather cautious and protective when we are talking about motherhood and the caring of a child?
Absolutely. I think we tend to be cautious and protective talking about pretty much everything,
yeah,
which can render our daily lives kind of a bummer, because we all walk around kind of brimming over with our own struggles and our own fear and problems. But, you know, we have to present a kind of an easily digestible, everything's fine, can't complain.
Right.
That's how we get through our lives. And I want literature to provide a relief from that.
And it seems almost heresy if you, as a mother and as a woman, say, oh, okay, but, you know, there are parts of this that really suck.
Mm-hmm. Or, you know, beyond really suck, that I think society's just not set up to really support.
Right.
So it's calling out the system more than just complaining about, like, oh, boo-hoo, my daily life is hard.
Right. There's more to it, that there is a systemic problem, and that's what we have to look at.
Right, and I think that's what's so threatening when we say, hold up, this is not ideal, this is not fantastic, and it's not hearts and roses, and there's some stuff here we should look closer at.
I'm hoping you can read a little bit from After Birth.
Sure. Yeah, I'll read a couple short sections.
Wonderful.
Okay. I was pretty much your big, round, regular, happy pregnant lady. Do you realize how nice everyone is to pregnant ladies? Manson's excluded. Nothing ironic about it. No way to downplay the honest-to-goodness-ness. I grew big, full of life. No irony. Not an iota. Not an iota of an iota. I mean, fine. There were one or two moments of acute, oh, shoot, this is really happening. But those moments did not undermine the honest-to-goodnessness, not one bit. Got slow and uncomfortable and slower still and even more uncomfortable and eventually impatient. Started to think I'd be pregnant forever. Paul got on my nerves. Certainly it would have been nice to have a woman around. Sister, mother, aunt, cousin, friend. Perhaps the absence of any began to crackle and hum, low at first, barely audible static. Maybe I mistook it for the white noise of the womb, persistent reminder of the magic therein. By the time I realized things were not going well, things were so far from well. Here's another little section from later on. At the baby's sixth-month checkup, a pediatric nurse asked a series of robotic questions. Have you thought about harming yourself or the baby? Are there guns in your house? Has the baby's father ever threatened you? Are you depressed in any way? I didn't say I imagined shooting myself 20 times a day. I didn't say I took strange, enormous comfort in these visions. I said, there are no guns in our house. I said, I guess a little depressed, sort of, yeah. She made a decisive mark on my chart and sent in the doctor. Nice guy, vegetarian, makes intelligent small talk while he does his exam. told me to get as much help around the house as we could afford, told me to find a group. No idea how to find help, but okay, a group. Drove up to Albany a couple times. Lots of the women in the group had surgeries, too. They either didn't speak of it or they spoke of it as perfectly normal, which I guess, hey, it is. They spoke of Zumba, stroller recalls, nursery schools, new hibachi place out by the mall. Who knew motherhood could be a mostly material experience? We'd sit in Starbucks rooting around in pastel camouflage diaper bags for chew toys and muslin wraps, while women without babies gave us endless dirty looks. Me and this one silent, dark-eyed woman, the only ones breastfeeding, the others busy with chemistry experiments, powders, cold packs, bottles. The poor babies were beside the point, like half-forgotten elderly consigned to our care. The girl babies looked like drag queens, ruffles and bows, a flower and rhinestone headpiece or two. One thusly adorned kept giving me a hilariously cranky look, like, can you believe this? She was cool. I winked at her, like, sorry, honey, I know, but it's not forever, I swear.
Alisa Albert reading from her new novel, After Birth, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Later in the novel, we meet the character Minna, who comes in and is an ex-rocker, mm-hmm. and she's 9 months pregnant, and maybe this is the person that Ari can work with and bounce some of this stuff off of.
Yeah, Ari finds a kindred spirit at just the right moment for both of them. They both need each other very badly.
Was that character also fully formed?
Yeah, that character, I was interested in somebody who had achieved some degree of notoriety, but who wasn't affected by it, who was just living her life and doing her work and not kind of getting any ego inflation out of sort of what she had accomplished. That arrived pretty early on.
In that relationship, what did you want to explore of the relationship between these two women, of really how they help one another?
Mm-hmm. I was drawn to that relationship because they are not threatened by each other at all. They don't approach each other with that all too common, you know, competitiveness or passive aggression, or they just fit together and they can each offer what the other one so badly needs. Minna can offer Ari friendship and an ear and validation for what she's been through and how hard it's been. And Ari can offer Minna support as she's getting used to having a newborn and learning how to feed her baby. And so it's like this corrective good fortune spiral that both can benefit from.
You use the word corrective, and I found it fascinating because there seems to be a confidence that each of them has in dispensing advice to the other that is so sorely lacking in their personal lives,
right.
That confidence.
Right. They fit together perfectly. Minna is totally confident and can offer Ari exactly the kind of validation she needs to say, oh, yeah, you're not crazy. None of what you're feeling is unreasonable. And Ari can say, oh, you're not crazy. This is really, really hard. And here's how we get through this.
In that idea of, I guess this is what we're ultimately looking for, is getting through it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or getting through it and being seen and heard and cared for. You know, I think it's a question of how we're treated when we're at our most vulnerable. If we're treated well at our most vulnerable, I think it can affect us positively for the rest of our lives. But if we're mistreated at our most vulnerable, that's very hard to overcome.
How difficult was it for you? Was it at all a challenge to write about Walker? And where that character of the child fits into this?
I was aiming for Walker to be sort of a separate entity. It's not Walker's story. And, you know, he's a baby with our working familiarity of, like, what babies are. And, you know, they're cute and they're hard work. And they have their own, you know, it's he's his own person.
Right.
But it sort of goes without saying that, like, this is not a story about a mother and her child, or even a mother and her spouse. It's really about a mother and herself and her personal history and this one friend.
What I found interesting, though, is because so often in entertainment, the child is used as like the big sweeps moment. So and so is going to have the baby on this special episode of, and then you never see the kid again.
Right.
But you are able to capture that while still the child is present.
Yeah, I just didn't want to exploit the child because we're familiar with those tropes, you know, like babies are funny, babies are can be a punchline. We can focus on a baby and avoid having a conversation with the adult who's also in the room. And I didn't want to do that. I wanted to, you know, it was a conscious decision to sort of ignore the baby. They call it benign neglect. It's kind of the current agreed upon sort of best mode of parenting. Make sure your children are safe and well-fed and clean and warm and maybe have a conversation with another adult.
How do you, and you're early in the process, but how do you see the book being accepted by readership and an audience?
Well, based on my previous experiences with past books, I think that some people will love it and find it a breath of fresh air and really grab onto it, and some will be very challenged and kind of offended, and it'll strike a chord that is hard for them to reconcile, so I'll get the brunt of that, and that's okay. I don't aim to write books that the most number of people will love. I just want to tell, quote-unquote, the truth, a truth as best I can, and if it's for somebody, that's great. If it's not for somebody else, that's okay, too.
But there's an understanding in writing a novel like this that you're going to perhaps ruffle a feather or two. But you seem to be very comfortable with that, actually.
I'm okay with that. It's a small price to pay for being able to say exactly what I want to say, exactly how I want to say it. And I'm all for compromising in certain areas of life, but, you know, art is not one of them. So, and I am kind of a provocateur by nature. I like to kind of push things as far as I can just to see what happens.
And the other balance, of course, is to say something and to have a message without it getting in the way of the story.
Right. Ari herself is very didactic, and that's just fun as a writer to just let fly with somebody's very extreme feelings and opinions. You know, in our daily lives, we moderate a lot. That's what civilization is. I don't want to have to do that in a novel.
And what is it about that we moderate so much, and yet when we read about someone who is being irrational, there's almost a breath of fresh air in that?
Right. It's relief.
Yes.
It's like laughter. You know, if we didn't have that occasionally, life is too suffocating. It's a burden to have to moderate all the time and be very responsible and think about what we say. It's a necessary burden, but it's a relief to just let fly sometimes. And I think a novel is a great safe space for that.
You mentioned your other two books, one being the novel, The Book of Dahlia, and the other, a short story collection. From the last novel, how do you think you have grown and this is the next step?
Well, this one's shorter, somewhat shorter, and I liked working shorter. I found it liberating to say less and to try to say more with less. So I think that that's a kind of an evolution. I'm interested to see how it plays out with the next one, and I don't know. I don't have a long enough career yet to really look back on, but I don't know. We'll see.
But you can do that in a word economy and also through the dialogue, just as you were mentioning, of allowing her to speak these words and let her do a lot of the heavy lifting in that character.
Right. The first person was really interesting for that. It's narrated by her.
Right.
So I got to kind of give my will as the writer over to this character. And that was fun.
Did you know that from the very beginning? That it was going to be written in the first person?
Very early. There's some choices I have to make at the beginning of a story or a novel in order to get very far at all. And until those choices have been made definitively, I'm not going to get anywhere. So I might spend a little bit of time mucking around, experimenting. Oh, maybe it's third person. Maybe it's first person. Maybe it's past tense. Maybe it's present, you know, but fairly quickly because I'm impatient and I want to get on with it. So I figure out what I need it to be and then we're off.
Does impatience ever get in the way of knowing when it's right, knowing when you have it to a point where you want it, or is there impatience that comes in and says, all right, well, it's time to move on to the next thing, and then I'll go back to that?
I'm very particular about sentences and the prose, and I can go a little bit further, and then I back up, and I'll sort of marinate in what I've done in order to get a little bit further. So I'm like, it's almost like beach combing or something. Like I'm just constantly going back over stuff and tweaking and rewriting sentences and erasing things and arranging it just so. And then I can kind of move forward another, 2 feet, and then I'm back through the whole thing again. And it's very nonlinear for me.
Mm. This book has a wonderful, I think Lydia Davis uses this word, but there's a wonderful moodiness to this.
Yeah, which is another liberation in this voice, because women are often punished to some degree for our emotions, our irrationality, our moodiness, the cyclical nature of our feelings and our thoughts. And I struggle with that. And I don't want to acquiesce to a sort of a patriarchal idea that, if thinking isn't linear or rational, it's worthless, because I don't think that's true. There's a lot of feminist ideology that gets batted around in this book. And I wanted the narrative itself to be making the point that, she's contradicting herself all the time.
Right.
And that is fine. And we're going to go with that.
And there's also almost a suspenseful nature to it, because you don't know how she's going to react.
Right. Which way is she going to go? Which is historically, that's kind of what's so terrifying about the female brain,
right.
Unpredictable and dangerous.
Men should read this, but probably won't, right?
Well, the ones in my life will.
There you go.
And, as we used to joke in college, every straight man who's hoping to date women should at least pretend to be a feminist, because it will help your cause.
But I'm fascinated just the way we market a book like this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we do have the pink rose or whatever flower that is. And I mean, it is marketed that way.
It is. I mean, well, women buy a disproportionate number of books. I don't know what the numbers are exactly, but
yeah.
Whoever reads it, that's cool with me. I mean, I hope I don't put my publisher out of business, but...
I doubt that would be the case. They're probably well on their way without you.
Oh, well.
It's a terrific novel. It's so much fun to read. It is Lisa Albert's new novel, After Birth. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and it's been such a pleasure to speak to you. Thank you so much for being with us, and best of luck with the new novel.
Always, Joe. Thank you.
Thank you. Lisa Albert's new novel is After Birth. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows, and you can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.